You're listening to the White Hot Magazine Art World Podcast. This is Noah Becker.
My name is Stephen Wozniak, and I'm your guest host on Art World, the White Hot Magazine of Contemporary Art Podcast. Artist Liz Magor seeks to reveal what is often hidden in plain sight, things that are always there but not always acknowledged. When she explores the detritus that constitutes the periphery of our lives, her work reveals layers of import never previously assigned to the common lost objects that make up a significant part of our many expected and wayward identities and narratives. By resuscitating discarded items and moments from the forgotten past, Magor preserves the steadfast, quiet, utterly necessary dialogue of life in artworks that sometimes act as fastidious simulations of our existence, though that are never the same as the original form or experience. Magor works in numerous three-dimensional and pictorial media, from ephemeral fabrics and robust cast steel to cardboard boxes and even the ash of extinguished cigarettes, and has produced a substantial body of work over the course of her remarkable 40-plus year career. Magor was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Magor's work has been the subject of numerous major survey solo exhibitions, including those at Kunstverein in Hamburg, Germany, Migros Museum in Zurich, Switzerland, the Art Gallery of Ontario in Toronto, Canada, and Triangle France in Marseille, France. Magor has also participated in such venerable international art exhibitions as Documenta, Castle, and the Venice Biennale. She and her works have been written about in such notable international publications as the New York Times, Art News, Art Forum, the Toronto Star, and Art in America, and in such books and catalogs as Elements of Nature, Contemporary Canadian Art, and Immaterial Rules of Contemporary Art, among others. Magor is considered one of Canada's most celebrated fine artists and is the winner of such prestigious awards as the Audain Prize for Lifetime Achievement in the Visual Arts and the Gershon Iskowitz Prize. Also lauded internationally, Magor recently received the French Order of Arts and Letters Medal for her contribution in the arts. Magor lives and maintains a rigorous studio practice in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. She is about to release a large volume of original written content entitled Subject to Change, the newest addition to the University of Concordia Press Text Context series, which seeks to reveal artists' relationship with their work, and includes celebrated artists such as Ken Lum, who I had the pleasure of interviewing on this program. In Subject to Change, Magor uses a narrative to make sense of her own body of artwork and themes, including subject-object relations and transformations, consumption and commodification, human attachment, relationships, and complexities of time, as well as her own life as a feminist artist in a settler colonial society. I am super excited that Liz Magor has come to join me today as a special guest on Art World, the White Hot Magazine of Contemporary Art podcast. Welcome, Liz, and thanks for talking a little bit today about you, your work, and now this book, Subject to Change, Writings and Interviews.
I will start with a quote from you that's in the book. The transgression of boundaries, the mixing of genres, the overlap of the imagined with the real, these have been art's stock and trade for several generations. To find it all in operation in the general population, therefore, demands a repositioning of the artist's role in the interest of avoiding redundancy. The shift might be from object to subject. Consider the found object, an artless thing emptied of meaning and filled with new intent. Consider the found subject, a sliding soul emptied of history and filled with new memories. It's a neat little passage. It sort of obviously highlights pretty big themes in your work that has carried through over the last 40 years or so. Subject to Change, Writing and Interviews includes a great deal of text, almost 300 pages, including catalog statements, essays, conversations, lecture notes, letters with gallerists and writers, and importantly, writings by you, including the book's preface. For someone who is a self-described non-writer with a bias of image over idea, how did you and Concordia University Press get together to organize, edit, and ultimately publish this book about you and your artwork, as well as text by you in some instances, and why now?
It was totally Jeffrey Little's idea. He's the editor. I wrote these things, as you say, over 40 years. And so often I didn't keep them. I often was writing them on a typewriter and sending them by fax to a curator or an editor or something like that. And my files are pretty shitty. You know, my paper world is very bad. And so I had been asked maybe 10 years ago to see if I could pull some together enough for a publication and maybe I could find five things. And I said, no, you know, it's really pretty paltry. Let's not go there. But Jeffrey, I didn't even know he was working on it. And he contacted me and said, look, I have all of this. He had over two dozen things that he had somehow dug up, I guess, in archives in different places. He lives in Montreal, so he's closer to where I was when I wrote a lot of them. I was living in Toronto then. So he could go to libraries, art gallery, archives, etc. So I thought, 25? Oh, holy cow, that means I was actually writing. You know, I hadn't identified any of my activity as writing activity because it was such, they're all short, in fact, you know. So it was Jeffrey. And then I said, yeah, well, maybe... Yeah, that's something. And it did take quite a few years, but he just kept finding them and finding them. And then I started digging around in boxes and different places and finding this and that. And so we found a lot more than we published. And then he also said, let's include works that had words in them. So some of them are kind of installations, but they have words in them. And he very cleverly, I think, included them as published like in a book. So you see, it's quite visual. The book is quite, you completely reproduced a book called Four Notable Bakers that is the one where I'm comparing bodies to lumps of dough and bread as though your body is material. So I was thinking, you know, these bodies are like the stuff I'm using in the studio. These bodies, we work on them without thinking about it. Like we try to keep them from getting really riddled with fat. We try to keep our livers not full of toxins, you know, so we're always kind of manipulating these bodies in the same way I was in the studio pushing chunks of rubber around.
Right.
You know, trying to make things roll or trying to make things, you know, sit up straight and that sort of thing. So that book that's called Four Notable Bakers is strictly images that are drawn from books, and Jeffrey decided to include it as, you know, a book work. It was a book work, but he did it again. So that's how you get up to 300 pages.
It's a lot of stuff. Let's talk about a little bit about what you do. You're known as an artist that pursues her work ostensibly as an investigation of relationships with things and with each other. How do you see yourself in your art, and how do you see your position as an artist among other artists or in the society at large?
Probably the word that would cover all of that would be that I'm an observer. And so when I started making the things that now I will call art, I was an observer and not so much an artist. My friends were artists. It was like the early 70s. My friends were artists. If they were painters, they were like Frank Stella.
Right.
If they were sculptors, they were like the California guys like John McCracken. If they were filmmakers, they were probably Andy Warhol-ish or something. And I thought they were great, like cool, great artists. I was going to university kind of studying Slavonic studies, you know, just doing different searching. And I thought what I'm doing is not art because it's not what they're doing. And so I was just observing, wanting in a way, the part that is me in the work is that I'm not satisfied or I'm restless, let's say. And I want to not just be in the world, but actually kind of be part of it in a certain way. And I want it to actually go outside of the boundary of myself. So I want to be part of what is immediately around me. So I'm observing the things that are immediately around me. So therefore, I'm not actually commenting on major social things, major social topics. Pop art was really prevalent when I was young, but it's about icons. It's about brands. It's about big things. Minimalism was also really prevalent. Those were the two avenues that were offered to me. I thought they were both interesting, but it wasn't giving me back what I wanted. Minimalism was a pretty radical proposition, and I loved the phenomenology of it. I loved that your body is necessary you don't see a minimalist work, you feel a minimalist work.
Right. It occupies your space, yeah.
That's right, it's phenomenological. So that probably, the phenomenology of minimalism was the most important thing that I learned from other art. But the erasure of all other stimulants, let's say like images or stories, especially narrative, the erasure of narrative is hard for me to swallow. I needed those things. So that meant I had to invent my own way of working. There were probably other artists working that way, no doubt there were, but they weren't really in my face or in my world. And this is before the internet, so you can't search. This is me living in Vancouver, so I'm not traveling very far. You know, traveling was harder in the 70s.
You weren't going to Paris and New York in a regular.
No, I wasn't. I was going to Kelowna. maybe Toronto. Toronto was a big trip. So Joseph Beuys was working, but I didn't know who he was. Yeah. I also wasn't buying art magazines. I needed to find it here, you know, like close to me. I wasn't doing research. I wasn't just kind of looking to see what other people were doing. I needed to find it here. I had a big deficit, let's say, a personal deficit in terms of how I connected to things. This would also, of course, be tied into the fact that I was a girl in a man's world or a boy's world. Mm-hmm. So there weren't a lot of precedents. So I kind of vaguely knew about Louise Bourgeois, and if I did in the 70s, it was before her Renaissance, that second wind that she had. Joseph Beuys wasn't showing in America because of the Vietnam War. I'm not sure of the date when he had that show. I think it was at the Guggenheim. So I didn't know about them, but that's kind of what I wanted to do.
Did you pay attention to the other sort of connected movements, the neo-dadaist and the Fluxus movements, people like, you know, Yoko Ono or Ibantasu or Johns or any of those people? I don't know. Maybe that's a stupid
question. I know. I'm embarrassed to say no.
No. Okay.
Fine. They all.
Well, here's a better question. What were your most significant influences creatively?
Writers, authors.
Writers, mostly writers.
Yeah, Samuel Beckett.
I understand you were interested in a lot of the written works of the Beat Generation, specifically On the Road by Jack Kerouac, and that book provided a particular influence of your use of cigarettes, which you've employed numerous times in your work as a medium in your work. Do you want to talk about that, or is that?
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Cigarettes are material. So going back to this thing about wanting to observe the relationship that we have, like we are the subjects, like we seem to be so important, and we have this relationship with material that we seem to be the boss of. But I know we're not the boss of material. I know that it's the boss of me, kind of. And cigarettes are classic bossy material, you know, like it will marry you and it will never divorce you. So I kind of was always interested in things like alcohol really interests me too, because it's just a material, but somehow it had learned how to overlap its subjectivity to mine. And so cigarettes are great also because they have such a short life. You know, they live and die within 5 minutes. And then they're also associated with attitude or sexiness or something, with cachet, with charisma. There's something also so fascinating about how that works. So lots of people have examined this relationship of cigarettes to cool or cigarettes to charisma. And it might have something to do with the smoker being a risk taker, meaning, well, what does that mean? For some reason, we think that's cool to take risks. Right. And maybe I still think that, you know, maybe I'm sort of addicted to trouble.
And those provide perfect avenues for addiction, alcohol and tobacco.
Right. So going back to the, so then, you know, I wasn't so interested in Jack Kerouac. I mean, I was, but again, he couldn't be a model for me. None of those guys could be models for me, which was so frustrating because they were doing kind of what I wanted to do, but big chunks were missing out of their program. chunks that totally have are connected to being a woman. There are certain things that you experience as a woman that you kind of want to examine. You maybe even want to talk about it.
Sure.
And they weren't, of course. They were busy with
being dudes.
Okay. Yeah, right.
So much later, leading the unexamined dude life. Or no, I guess the examined dude life because they wrote books about it. But yeah,
they did. They did a lot. They did a lot. I'm not deriding them, but. But sometimes I laugh at them. Sometimes
yes, of course. Yeah.
Foolish. Yeah. Just one more thing about cigarettes is that if you associate them with cool, and if artists still smoke, I don't know if your circle of friends still smoke, but mine still does. And I think, here you are. That's fucking amazing. That I don't.
I don't either, that they've made it that far.
Right. But then I have this other thing that holds me back from admiring it so much, and it is that I don't think artists should be cool. I think they should be hot or warm or something, you know. Right. They should be able to be embarrassed and to be humiliated and to be wrong. Mm-hmm. And cool, you can't, right? You have to cancel a lot of things in order to be cool.
That's right.
Yeah, you have to cancel any kind of display of emotion. You have to keep it deep, 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 deep.
Right.
So
it hurts after a while.
Yeah, it hurts after a while. It's maybe not good for art.
Yeah, I agree with you. Having developed as a person and an artist during a really highly charged and critical political and social climate of the 60s in North America, your work was able to contribute to the development of sort of latent postmodernist feminist movement. What does it mean to be a feminist artist? Or what does that mean to you? And what's it like to work as a sculptor in what is perceived as largely a man's creative field, which we just sort of alluded to right now? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a really crucial period, and you sort of came through the fire and have continued on. Or do you not consider your work in that way? Do you see a bigger picture?
Well, I see a bigger picture, but it's still, I can still include myself as a feminist. I think the way I look now, let's say I was an Indigenous person or a person of color now, how much pressure would I feel to make work about that fact? And if I was an Indigenous person or a person of color, I would think I'm that plus other stuff. Mm-hmm. I have other parts to me. And maybe I'd want to make work about those other parts and not about the fact of my racial identity. Or so I felt the same way as a woman. I didn't really want to make work about women's issues. I wanted to make work in a way that feminists were outlining as a possibility, which would mean to include emotion, which would mean to include your subjecthood, mm-hmm. to include valorizing things that had been unvalorized, like narrative, like soft materials. I remember some of the comments about Eva Hesse when she was alive, mm-hmm. were not very complimentary. They were, she was called touchy-feely. I remember my male colleagues would say, oh, her work is just touchy-feely.
That's too bad.
That doesn't show up now in these big catalogs that are devoted to her work. That's all been erased. Just as a lot of the, you know, the comments about Joni Mitchell have been kind of erased.
Sure.
Because now we realize she's a genius, you know.
Of course.
I'm getting to your question.
Oh, sorry.
I'm a digressive talker. So I wanted to work the way feminism would allow me to work, which would be to explore things that weren't legacy, things that weren't important, that weren't already in history. But I didn't want to actually just deal with topics of the fact that I was a woman. Sure. So that's how I went. So my colleagues who were women at the time were probably dealing with Freud, talking right. about Freud or Charcot or something like that, right. Talking about hysteria, looking in old books about women's experience, doing things, you know, that displayed how angry we can be about this. But I didn't want to do that. I eschewed all of that. I just right. Went somewhere else.
Do you feel that it's important to take a sort of wide look, to take a few steps back and act as a critic of your own work? How important is that, reviewing, taking the wide look of your work?
Yeah, I don't step back very far.
Okay.
Most of the writing is done after the work. So, and when I was teaching, I would always suggest to students that they write after they've finished a work. They think about it after they've made the work. Think about it afterwards. Write about it, because a lot of the writing in the book that I've done with Jeffrey is I'm writing about something I've done. I'm not sure what I've done. And the writing, because language is more precise, I know it better. It's kind of more controllable. Words are, I mean, I can kind of do an excavation a little bit better with language. And so I'll excavate a work, but that will be just months after a work or a year after a work. And then I'll try to forget so that I can be in the here and now for each work I'm making. So I'm like a dog digging a hole. And I don't get out of the hole and go up and look at the pile that I've made on the side of the hole too often. Because what will I find there? I'll just find more dirt.
When you do write that, though, does it act as like some kind of a touchstone that informs other work? Or is it just, hey, it's a time for review and you put it away and you get back into the thick of it, back in the studio?
If I do it well, it's a revelation. It's like going to a shrink where you say, you know, I'm doing this, everybody's mad at me now and I don't know why. And then you do an examination, you say, oh yeah, now I know why everybody's mad at me. So you kind of, if I do it well, I have an insight, I gain an insight. And then that insight becomes useful for the next work. Conceivably, the work improves over time, but I'm not going to judge whether it does or doesn't.
I had the pleasure of interviewing a colleague of yours, or I think you guys were colleagues, Ken Lum, recently.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Ken sort of passed me this question. How did you adjust to the advent of a pandemic as an artist? How did your studio practice change, your focus and attention, and you? Over the course of the last few years. Yeah. I mean, some artists loved it. They figured, this is great. I don't have to leave the studio. I can work continuously. I don't have to worry about working towards a physical show. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to ask you that same silly question, but I'm sure your answer is not so silly.
No, my answer is pretty, you answered it for me. I was one of those that loved it.
Yeah.
I don't work for exhibitions. I mean, emotionally, I don't work for exhibitions. In a practical sense, I do. And so if you take the practical away, then I'm left just with me. That's the best possible thing. And then in addition to that, my way of working in the studio is pretty self-sufficient. Because I don't start a work with a big notion of how it's going to proceed, it means I iterate every moment. I'm kind of shifting and changing, asking a question and then using the answer as the way to go for the next 10 minutes or the next day. So because of that way of working, I have to have a pretty well-supplied studio. I have about 1,000 square feet, and it's full of all the tools and materials that I could possibly need for a month, let's say. So it means that that's my favorite place to be, and that's my favorite way to work, so that it's very... in the moment, is very happening now. And if I even have a date in the evening or an appointment in the morning, it ruins the whole day, because I need this unlimited time to be happy. And so pandemic was 2 years unlimited time. It doesn't get better.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Score.
Yeah.
And no, you don't work with assistants, or you do, I guess, for maybe public works projects?
I do, yeah. Sometimes I bring in a group of people, or two or three people, as I get closer to an exhibition, because by then I know what I'm doing and I can hand off some of the process. There's a lot of making, there's a lot of doing. I don't go out to shops at all. I, you know, like shops like a metal shop.
Yeah, or so you send them out.
yeah, that's right. I don't use the internet in the studio. I don't have internet in the studio. So it really is kind of like a shop or a lab or something. Recently, though, I have now a regular assistant who comes a few days a week because I'm getting sloppier and more impatient. It just goes with aging, I guess. He actually said, well, you know, the problem is you need a headlamp and you need a better pair of glasses. So he got the glasses for me and he got the headlamp. And I said, okay, Josh, you're fired. I'm good now.
Like, it's kind of nice. I have one too that I use.
Yeah, a headlamp. Yeah. Shoes. Why I didn't think of that earlier. So anyhow, I have Josh there 3 days a week and it makes a big difference. It's good.
Many of your works from recent pieces like Coiffed and Dressed, which feature laid to rest color desaturated stuffed animals, to older pieces like Time and Mrs. Tiber, which is a wall of preserved food and recipes on a shelf, sort of frozen in time, they act like shrines or altars that intensify the undertone of violation, sacrifice, and loss, ultimately. For me, at least. Talk to me about sort of the intention of this kind of format versus, say, a narrative tableau, the kind of thing you'd find like in a wax museum or a themed museum or something. Obviously, your work, it sort of goes in this other direction. Was there a conscious effort to sort of say, these are going to be more like shrines versus this sort of tableaus? I mean, you don't work in linear narrative anyways, but just sort of a contrast.
Yeah, I have to think about narrative because we use narrative in a certain predictable way. And I think there's other ways to use it. So one way to use narrative or the narrative impulse is to not supply everything to that narrative impulse. And so let's say I might liken it to going into a store that isn't organized. That's maybe you might call it a junk store, where things aren't organized. So I don't call them junk stores. I call them kind of archives, let's say. And I like to go in because things have fallen out of their orbit. They've fallen out of the story that they were produced under. I think a lot about production too, you know, all this stuff that's coming towards us. We didn't even ask for this stuff, but somehow it's coming at a pretty fast rate and a pretty huge volume. And so probably we jump on a narrative in order to deal with it. Like, what is this for? Do I need this? Do I want this? And so those narratives are useful. But then after these things pass through our lives and they're behind us and we're sick of them and we're tired of them, we have no desire for them, they're still hanging around in, you know, huge quantities of it.
Right.
So that's where I encounter the material world, not at the onset of desire, but at the end of desire when it's leaving. And I question what happened to the desire, because the material didn't change. The sweater is still pink, it's still fluffy, but I guess pink is not this month's color. So I wouldn't use the word shrine exactly, but I do take those things after they're exhausted or after we're exhausted with them, but they're still kind of alive. And I guess in a way, this is a surrealist tactic to join it to something else that's unexpected, and that livens it up in a whole different way. So I'm actually juxtaposing things that are maybe not, you know, with eyeballs the way surrealists do, maybe not fetishistic materials that the surrealists use, but other non-things, other discarded things will meet discarded things in unexpected conjunctions. So I don't think of them as shrines exactly. They are kind of deadish. That's a true thing. Don't know what to do about that.
You said in an interview that I thought this was interesting, that you said you try to overlook the making of something and its journey to exhibition regarding your work, which is interesting, especially in light of your significant consideration of objects, their life and death and rebirth. Why release sort of the art, you know, the children, so to speak, and not review that aspect of it? Is that just too like, oh my God, now I'm thinking more about my responsibility to these objects when they now belong in collections and go off to museums and other places?
Well, they're out of my they're off my table. They're not under my auspices. I can't control them. I can't control what people think about them. Or, you know, maybe I would sometimes want to extend my control into the care of the work. So I do kind of worry about them being looked after. You know, that's why I kind of welcome collectors, good collectors who will look after the work, and then I'll just leave it. Then I'll just leave it. There's only so many hours in the day, so I have to stay doing what I can do with my, you know, with all my resources, as opposed to trying to stick my finger in every aspect of it.
So what are you working on now?
I'm working just at this time, I'm working for an exhibition for my gallery in Paris that will be in the spring.
Excellent.
And some sculpture. Then as I'm doing that, I'll start a new bunch of work that's for an exhibition in Toronto at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Toronto, and that's for the fall. So these things kind of, so I'm deeply into the Paris stuff now, and I'm starting to see a break. I think the Paris stuff knows what's happening. Right. I can bring on this new stuff that I don't know what's happening, and I just try to keep it going. I take the spring off completely, and I go up to an island that I am connected to up the coast, and because I like to just watch the grass go green. So yeah. I go up for May and June, sometimes April, May, June, sometimes May, June, July, and I don't do any art. I just watch the grass grow or something. So that's why that for the other, how many months left? 9 months, I'm kind of...
Which is kind of perfect, right? That's the term of a pregnancy. It's like you're giving birth to all this art.
9 months?
And then you have maternity leave for 3 months.
I didn't even do the math, you know?
Well, Liz, thank you so much for joining us on Art World, the White Hot Magazine of Contemporary Art.
Liz Magor's upcoming book, Subject to Change, Writings and Interviews, published by Concordia University Press as part of the Text Context, Writings by Canadian Artists series, is now available through booksellers worldwide in paperback form. Liz Magor is represented by Catriona Jeffries in Vancouver, British Columbia, and Andrew Krepp's Gallery in New York City. To learn more about Liz and her work, go to www.andrewkreps.com and www.catrionajeffries.com. To learn more about the White Hot Magazine of Contemporary Art, go to www.whitehotmagazine.com. And to learn more about me, Stephen Wozniak, your guest host, go to www.stephenwozniakart.com and www.stephenwozniak.com, as well as at stephenwozniakart on Instagram. Thank you again for listening to another great podcast episode of Art World, the White Hot Magazine of Contemporary Art.